Henry Silverman
in Maryland. He and I go way back. I forget when I first met you, probably 15 years ago.
And, yeah, I don't go way that far back anymore. I say.
And Dr. Silverman has been working in the Middle East, mostly in Egypt. Maybe you can describe some what you've been doing there in the research ethics world. And what else is going to mention about this? Oh, yeah, we should go around and introduce ourselves.
Right, yeah, so if I could, I don't think I have enough, but if I could do some, I don't know why they call it shameless promotion. This is shameful promotion, okay? And so this is a brochure on the Fogarty program that I'm currently involved in. So basically trying to enhance research ethics capacity. It started at mainly in Egypt, and since then I have recruited trainees from all the other countries in the Middle East, the resource limited countries. So I've had people from Saudi Arabia who would self-fund themselves for the program. So I've had people from Egypt, Sudan, Yemen, Jordan, Lebanon, and I'm trying to say another country, but I think that's it. And it's been, what could I say, great experience interacting with these different cultures and trying to learn from them regarding their systems of ethics review and also their systems of research. So so that's my spiel. So we could go clockwise. How's that? You're next up. That means you're next.
Okay, my name is Baraka Morris. I'm from Tanzania. I'm 4MB student. Okay, back in my country, I'm a nurse, registered nurse.
Okay, very good.
One of the fellow in Fogarty scholarship.
Okay, great.
I'm Christine Davison, and I work at Penn's IRB as an IRB administrator, and I'm just taking classes in the program right now.
Okay.
I'm Ben. I work at the IRB as well, and I'm enrolled into the bioethics program.
I'm Blair. I'm a nurse. I work over at the Children's Hospital in the ICU, and I'm getting my master's in nursing and in bioethics.
Okay. My name is Jackie. I'm a research coordinator at Penn, and I'm also getting my MBA.
Okay.
And this is Farchi.
I'm Ted Reese. I'm on the medical faculty at Vanderbilt and translational research, and I'm finishing up my master's.
I'm Ed Connor. I'm a pediatrician on the faculty at Children's National in D.C.
My name is Katrina Burns, and I'm a graduate of the Lumen program, and I'm currently getting a master's in reading, writing, literacy with a focus on science and health literacy and health disparities.
Manson Koshi, I'm a fellow in developmental and behavioral pediatrics at Children's Hospital, and I'm in the master's program here.
Okay.
I'm Caitlin Bailey. I'm a research assistant in the translational research lab at Penn, and I'm also working on my MLA.
I'm Allie. I'm an undergraduate intern at the Center for Bioethics this summer.
Ken Clothen. I'm a healthcare lawyer and public policy person, government person, and finishing up the MBA program here.
Hi, I'm Robin Parcell. I work for the Board on Health Science Policy with the Institute of Medicine at the National Academies of Science. I'm a second semester MBE student.
Okay.
I'm Miho. I'm a research fellow at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and I'm a research for fetuses.
Okay.
I'm Mir. I'm Associate General Counsel for our Cancer Center here, and I negotiate research agreements. Many of them are clinical trial agreements. All of them are domestic. I'm hoping to matriculate into the MBE program this fall.
Okay, all right.
My name is Bill Konecki. I'm an MBE student here and a DND student in the Dallas School.
Hi, my name is
Steven,
and I'm a perio resident at the dental school doing a master's.
Okay.
I guess I'll go next. I'm Richard Cockrell. I'm a medical student, and I'm also in the MBE program here.
Okay.
Karen, clinical trial coordinator.
Oh, okay. All right. Good. And who are you? And who may you be? All got the cases and have read through the cases, and now the other thing is I have a few slides. Is this set up for?
We didn't prepare for it, but I can probably do it.
Okay. What's that?
Give a disc or give a computer.
I just have the iPad, but I have stuff on the flash drive.
Will the iPad plug in?
What's that?
Will the iPad plug into the projector?
Well, I don't. I didn't convert the slides into the keynote. I see.
John, listen to it. I just don't know how to plug it in.
But, I mean, I don't need it right away.
Do it at break or something?
Yeah, something like that. So, I don't know exactly how do you want to work this, one of the cases I sent was the hepatitis E vaccine trial in Nepal, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, and so I sent you two cases, and then the Zion article.
Everybody here read the Zion article and actually answered the questions on vulnerability.
Oh, okay. Well,
that might be a good starting.
Yeah. I was just going to say maybe we could start with. With that, I guess what I wanted to show was the questions that I gave out. Did I on that sheet? Did I give the prisoners regulations?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And in fact, actually, do you have an extra copy of the questions?
Never first had this.
Oh, okay, great. Okay, fantastic. All right, great. Why don't we start with that? So you have the prisoner regulations, the question is, tell me. What do you think prisoner research is restricted to those categories? We could do on anybody else who could give consent. Any research that's approved by the IRB is permitted, but in their infinite wisdom, when these regulations were written, why these categories? What's the is there a rhyme and a reason, or a reason why these categories were chosen? Just to be clear, I guess. Let's see now. We had the categories. You all have the categories in front of you? Okay. All right, so what a free-flowing exchange of ideas. What do you think these categories were selected? What's the overarching theme going on here?
It has to specifically affect the prisoner population, or couldn't be performed on any other population to get the cutting down.
Okay. All right. And all right. Good. Other thoughts?
I'm thinking that a prison population is
I incarcerated individuals. The overarching theme was sort of because of the prolonged incarceration, there's an internalizing of the experience. And so that comes with certain vulnerabilities. And so these rules and regulations were meant to oversee that. So the rules and regulations were meant to protect not only the prisoners from unethical research, but also the prisoners from themselves and what that process does to how they think of themselves as people who can volunteer.
So how is this all linked to their vulnerability?
I think it's just an extreme case of, lack of freedom. I mean, a vulnerable population tends to have their rights restricted, their freedoms restricted, and here is someone who physically is restrained within a system and can't play it out militarily.
So how does restricting research to these categories deal with their vulnerability? What's the link?
I think it prevents them from being used just because they're conveniently all located in one building and they can't leave. So if there's all those specific categories, it kind of protects them from, somebody unscrupulous who just wants to use them just because they're all right there. And it keeps them from being, just used because they're conveniently located. Sample time.
One of the categories, 43.3064, talks about focusing on research that's strictly for the benefit. And I think part of my purpose, my thoughts on the vulnerability part, is to make sure that because in research like that you have control groups, which may or may not get the benefits of the treatments that are being tested. So the vulnerability is making sure that because if you have a research that's strictly for the benefit, then even if you have a control group that's not going to get that benefit, when the research is over, all of the prisoners have a chance of getting it. So it's not based on withholding any treatment from the control group that they might need, but basically just enhancing their current status.
So let's say if there was some research involving some inherent characteristic of being a prisoner and there was a control group, would that be not a good study to do?
It's a good study to do if I'm thinking that if the research results in something that enhances, it's not something that's going to withhold treatment from that control group. I mean, they're not going to be worse off by having it withheld, but it's going to be something that's going to help them see if the enhancing characteristics or whatever they're trying to improve from the non-control group makes a difference. And so if it does, then when the research is over, they all can have access to it. So I was thinking in terms of distributive justice of the benefits of the research.
Right.
So would you say that an HIV trial of a new drug adequately controlled could only be done if the drug company or the... what would the condition be that you'd place on a clinical trial? So it's a new drug, it's a phase 3 clinical trial, you don't know if it's going to actually come onto the market or not. Is it okay to do?
Well, I'm basing what the wording of the regulation talks about just strictly for the improvement of their health. So I'm thinking that the control group is the group that does not have, does not have any like illness or anything that they're just trying to, like, say for instance, if they're trying to prove that a vitamin will work better, So it's not going to affect the control group if they don't have it. It's just going to enhance. So I'm thinking that what they're trying to do is strictly beneficiary and not something that's going to cause harms by withholding from the control.
Because it's HIV and that you can't do a placebo control trial. So it's either, let's say it's an added therapy trial or something like that.
Yeah.
So with you saying, what are the conditions that you place, given what you've said about access to post-trial benefits, essentially, what would you require of them, of whom, of the prison administration, of the state, of the federal government, or the drug company, to be able to run that clinical trial in
prison. A prison? So is this an HIV prevention?
It's an actual... It's a treatment trial.
So it may be important to know how prevalent that particular condition is in that particular prison?
Well, assuming there's patients there, I mean, if they're going to set up a clinic and all, they're just going to have enough patients there.
I think post-trial access would be pretty important because access to the post-trial access of should the drug prove successful to the participants and generally to the population would be important in this case, I think, because it's a trial that can likely benefit other HIV-infected population outside of the prison, and therefore issues of unfair burden on this particular population because they're available and have limited capacity to exercise sort of free choice.
Okay, so you agree?
I agree, yeah.
So who makes that decision? And at what point is that decision made? I mean, a new drug, it's going to be charged, it's going to be very expensive, there are other drugs on the formulary. Who could make the commitment?
I think the commitment should be outlined at the outset of the trial as part of the research design. Because it's not something you come to at the end and say, okay, maybe these resources are available or not available. Sure. But obviously I'm placing a higher threshold on some of this than is discussed in the regulations.
What about this notion of doing research on the least vulnerable population possible? Why wouldn't you say, okay, John, drug company, if you want to do this, try this HIV drug, you have to first convince me that there's no other population with a lesser vulnerability in which you can do the same research. That would seem to me to be more important than even before, long before you got the issue of post-trial benefits. Because that's going to really hang you up when you start looking at resource-constrained environments in general. But long before that, there's sort of this general rule of you don't go to the most vulnerable if there's an easier way to get at the issue. If there's another way to answer the question.
Let's look at the regulations, I guess. Would this sort of trial fall under 306? That's the one where it's a trial that could generally be applicable to other people. So my response to that question in the response paper was that basically I don't think the 306 trials should be allowed at all.
Because of Francis's constraint?
Yes. Because all it requires is discussion with some experts and publication of the notice, and then you can do the trial. And that seems to be a little bit pro forma, because you could always have experts who are used to working with prison officials and clinical researchers, and what does the publication of the notice do? I mean, maybe some advocacy groups read the Federal Register, but most probably don't. So that fourth category of research under 306A24 seems to me to be totally sort of questionable when done with prisoners. The only thing I can think of, Francis, would be that that somehow we would like the prison population to have benefits of the research, new and sort of cutting edge research as well.
If I'd been asking the question, I probably would have started with multi-drug-resistant TB, which is endemic, certainly in most prisons in Russia, for example. I would have to say, is there really no other population in which you can ask this question? Because if you could, the prison population can still reap the benefit of the findings without having to have taken on the risk. So I'm just suggesting that before you ever ask a question about post-trial access or even follow-up, you have to go back to the basic premise of why are you doing it in this population? Is it the only one in which you can ask this question?
If you're taking on any more risk than the other population.
what's the same? What you were calling the least vulnerable population.
Well, it speaks not so much to the degree of risk as it does to the degree of vulnerability.
Couldn't it actually be lower risk for them?
Possibly. I'm not saying you couldn't do your trial. I'm just saying that's the part of the calculus that I think has to come in here. Right? I can study hypertension drugs in lots of populations before I ever walk into a prison and do it.
Which is actually interesting. I don't know if you want to jump in here, but my one observation about this is that, you know, a lot of people right now seem to be selling the benefits of being in research. It's kind of like for the last couple of years, they've been selling this idea that there is a benefit, and you don't want to deny populations access to trials. And I've always kind of chuckled at that because it's like it presumes that, you know, it's like this is a really good thing. And yeah, from a societal perspective, we need them, but for subjects' perspective, it's not always a good thing. Half the time, in fact, or less than half the time. More than half the time, it's not. I mean, most of the time, trials don't work out.
Well, I mean, that's the other side of justice. Should we deny them access to the potential benefits of the research? So this morning, I was discussing one of these complicated chemotherapy trials, okay? One of these toxic new chemotherapy drugs, comparing it to two other standard chemotherapy drugs in this patient population, not prisoners, but a patient population with advanced metastatic breast cancer, in which patients had failed previous therapy. Okay, and this would give chemotherapy trials. If patients live another 3 months, you know, progression-free disease. That's bring out the wine glasses, they were also going to recruit patients who were mentally incompetent with surrogate consent. And so on one hand, you could do that study without involving the mentally incompetent, but then the other side of the coin, I mean, these are patients, you know, with end-stage cancer, and should we deny the mentally ill the opportunity, if you want to call it that, or the chance to be enrolled in this study, in this chemotherapy study? I think those are the two sides of the same coin. On one hand, we don't need the mentally incompetent patients to do the trial. On the other hand, do we deny them the opportunity to participate in the potential benefits? So what do you think?
Is it a later trial, like phase three, or is it more experimental? Is it just
It's a new experimental drug versus
phase one, phase two. Okay.
Yeah, right. I never really found it helpful to categorize the phases because, you know, now we have phase, you know, 2A and 2B and 3A and 3B. It sounds like, you know, a Shakespearean play. But anyway,
I mean, I just
you
think
could
if it's
call
like
it phase three,
phase one or something, then yeah. No, I don't think that there's any reason to enroll mentally incompetent people. But if it's later and it's shown some efficacy, then, you know, maybe they should be able to be enrolled.
Well, let's say it's phase one, and, you know, a lot of oncology trials mm-hmm. are phase one, and you know, some people maintain that 5% of patients could get a benefit, has shown mm-hmm. could get a benefit from even phase one trials in chemotherapy, because I mean, most of the times when we think about phase one trials, we think of trials in which we're enrolling healthy volunteers, but in cancer trials, mm-hmm. phase one, there's a small potential for mm-hmm. benefit. Yeah, you could call it salvage therapy, last chance therapy. So do you deny individuals the opportunity to, you know, this is their last chance for treatment. No other treatment out there.
May I ask you how the consent process would work? Do you know?
Surrogate consent. Yeah, surrogate consent.
In reference to the study population, how large is it?
It was a multi-center. Multi-center, you know, I mean, usual cancer protocols, you know, hundreds of patients, right, in order to show an effect, statistically significant effect. I mean, look at the cardiology trials. They have a signal of 1% difference between the two groups, and the reason why it's winds up being statistically significant is because they enrolled 20,000 patients, right? You know, the sample size is inversely proportional to the square of the signal. So, but not to get off the track. So, I mean, having said all this, I mean, we've been saying a lot of things. What would Zion and her colleagues say about enrolling prisoners in whom you could enroll participants who are less vulnerable? Because it does seem that in the third category, that if it's research on conditions affecting prisoners, particularly affecting prisoners as a class, but it seems like that could affect other non-prisoners as well. Is that right? So how did that get in the regulations? I mean, is that relevant? Do you think it's provide enough of a safeguard for enrolling prisoners?
Sorry, which one?
The PHS, I mean, the federal regulations.
I'm sorry?
Are you talking about the federal regulations?
Yeah, right, right, yeah.
I mean, certainly these go...
I'm sorry?
These go far beyond, I mean, the Zion approach goes far beyond what's in the federal regulations.
It goes far beyond in what way?
Well, in the amount of engagement of the community that is sort of either required in those guidelines to be able to do research ethically.
Well, engagement of the community, but I guess with... in terms of the types of conditions affecting the vulnerable group, I mean, what does Zion, I mean, say in terms of you know, what kind of illnesses or disease?
They take a very, you know, they take a much more sort of extreme approach from a philosophic perspective, the way I'm looking at it, from a philosophic perspective as well as from the population perspective. So they in their paper say that sort of the context really sort of has to do with rights and healthcare rights, you know, and they actually say that the whole idea about consent is almost a farce. Because they look at it from a very different conceptual framework, so they think that only research should be done on before going there. The way they define it, just about anybody can be a vulnerable population because it has to do with rights and power relationships. Very different than sort of what's in the, you know, the federal guidelines, which really has to do with consent. For the most part, the vulnerable populations were defined and have to do with consent. So the way they look at it is, based upon that population, have certain health needs, and only that research should be done on that patient population to address their very specific health needs. That's it's a very more limited, very specific approach.
But yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was just going to note that they use this term. The research has to be specifically related to inherent characteristics of the vulnerable group. but they sort of gloss over whether when those characteristics are also characteristics of non-vulnerable groups, whether that makes the research...
Who glosses over?
Zion and her colleagues.
Is that right?
Yeah. I think so.
Tell me why.
Well, in the shaded portion where they actually give their regs, so to speak, number two says medical research should not proceed on vulnerable groups unless the research is specifically related to inherent characteristics of that group and not related, for example, to the needs or preferences of the researcher.
Right.
But there are many conditions in which are both inherently related to the health needs of the vulnerable, to the characteristics of the vulnerable group, and also to characteristics of the general population.
Let's say a lot of research is being done in the developing world on diabetes. Okay? And, pharma is going into, countries like India, China, all over the Middle East, Turkey, Egypt, and doing trials, investigating, what did I say, diabetes? Okay. what's wrong with that?
The inherent characteristic condition isn't the only condition they've outlined. There are others, the community engagement and meaningful consent and post-trial benefits. There are other conditions that Zion et al. Are exhorting about that would ameliorate, I think, some of the risks. So if the characteristic inherited the population and also shared by others, and let's say a less vulnerable population couldn't be found, or you wanted to share the benefits of a particular kind of research with this vulnerable population, I think the other conditions would go a long way toward ameliorating some of these concerns.
I mean, that's the point I'm trying to make, is that the threshold condition is about that the research relates to these inherent characteristics of the vulnerable group. These other issues are what I would characterize as sort of process issues, which if you meet those, then it seems to me that even under the more stringent, as you pointed out, approach of Zion et al., it seems to me you can still do research on conditions which are shared by the vulnerable group and the general population. Diabetes would be a perfect example.
See, I didn't get that sense from that paper.
Okay.
I got the opposite sense from that paper, that basically diabetes forgets.
Right.
Okay, that's a Western disease. Okay, that's not our problem. Our problem is something else. Mm-hmm. And that you should only do that in that public. I'm not saying I agree with that, but I think that was what they were saying.
Yeah, no, I think that's the sense that I got too, is that they were very restrictive about things that almost... Well, they at least had to be, the population had to be concerned about their health issue, and it had to be an entity that existed within the population. It says actually only.
Yeah, right. It's
specifically within the population. There would be an unusual number of human diseases that would only occur in prison.
Tropical illnesses?
Well, maybe, but not occur
malaria?
In anybody else. Well, they still occur elsewhere.
Right? Well, but predominantly?
Well, that's where I was struggling with where the line was, because it says research on the disease that only affects...
That only affects a particular population. So,
And that's in the discussion and not in the enumerated...
No, it's in the shaded box. It says this would include, for example, research on a disease that only affects a particular population. So it adds that...
It would include... Well,
what?
It's a lawyer's point, but I mean, it would include, but it does. But that doesn't mean that it excludes diseases that aren't... I mean, again...
Do you not like where they put the word only?
It would include a disease that only affects a particular population.
That only affects.
Right, it would include that, but it doesn't exclude others.
Right.
The only point I'm trying to make is that it seems to me that this I think is sort of a weakness of this paper, in that the discussion, outlines a general approach that I think intends to be much more limiting. But when you get down to actually writing the rules, it's very hard to make it that limiting.
Because why is it hard to make it that limiting?
Because then you're...
Why?
It's hard to make it that limiting unless you're willing to exclude a huge percentage of the research that is actually being done.
That's right.
And so when they get to actually... Well, I think that's the gut motivation. But when they get to actually making the rules, I think they sort of... It seems to me that they actually realize that that's sort of impractical or...
But that doesn't lead to the failure of the paper. I mean, they say it's by no means obvious that these conditions will be met, and what they're asking for is a philosophical shift in the approach, which you've identified. And when you read this paper against the prisoner regulations, it's a real philosophical shift, I think, particularly. I mean, I didn't focus so much on the inherent characteristics as much as community engagement and what does that mean for a prison.
The process issues, I completely agree.
I wouldn't write that off as just process.
I'm not writing them. I don't believe it's ever just process issues. It seems to me that the thrust of the paper...
I didn't read this as a threshold condition. I mean, if a community comes and says, let's say in a theoretical community, there is a theoretical body who can decide what the research priorities of that community are. And they come and say, you know, diabetes is, which it is in developing countries among certain populations, an increasing research importance. I think all these conditions, and if you go through all these conditions, your threshold condition would have been met. So I didn't sort of elevate the inherent characteristic above the other three conditions. And I sort of read all four. It's ideal to have all four exist. If you can have only one exist, the inherent characteristics would be very important. But it would work if you could make all four exist in some fashion or another.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with that analysis.
Yeah.
Yes, I just want to highlight the last sentence on, given the debate that we're just having, in the extreme position, I think they're taking the last sentence on page 616, I think is important. They say medical research does not meet these conditions, no matter how well intentioned, would not be ethical and should not proceed.
Right. By the way, somebody has their iPhone on with their email.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. It's just I feel like it's the end of a. Of a round. anyway, we're going back and forth between prisoners and developing countries, which is fine, because that's where we want to go. In terms of the prisoner regulations, would it be fair to say that the prisoner regulations approaches Zion's wish list, if you want to call it that, that only on conditions that are that only affects the prisoners?
I thought that 3 and 4 of the federal regulations really kind of fit right in with the Zion, I guess, guidelines or recommendations. The first two, probably not so much, categories 1 and 2.
One is possible causes, effects, and process of incarceration.
Well, yeah, I guess that would still, since it just affects that population and is probably inherent to that population. But...
Two is a study of prisons as institutional structures.
Yeah, but I don't think that meant that it would directly benefit them for number two. I don't think that directly benefits prisoners.
If they looked at the structures of
prison
life.
Yeah, maybe long term, yeah. But it seemed like Zion was calling for more really immediate. I don't know. That's when I read the Zion paper, I thought that their guidelines were kind of... They want it to be something that would directly benefit them, like, you know, nowish. I don't know. I didn't think long term.
Okay.
Comparing and contrasting them.
Okay. In those first two categories, mm-hmm. The other additional clause there is it says now. So it's safe to say that those first two categories doesn't have a potential of direct benefits to the prisoners, right?
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, what's the other restriction?
Minimal risk.
That's right, minimal risk.
Minor inconvenience.
Right. So it's there's long-term benefits in the future for prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so again, in research, we have benefits to potential benefits to the participants, and then the reason why we do research is mainly for generalizable knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first two regulations is okay. They're not going to benefit from it directly, but as long as it is no more than minimal risk, it's okay.
I was going to say, I feel like prisoners could, under 1 and 2, still benefit.
Directly?
Yeah, I think definitely if it's a...
Immediately?
I mean, if it's a behavioral study, for example, 1, it could be relieving boredom. If you're in prison, you don't have anything to do. It could give them a feeling of personal satisfaction to be engaged in the research, so maybe kind of an indirect benefit to the prisoner.
Benefit or...
Or even just like helping prisoners see like why they ended up in prison, working through those patterns of behavior, and helping them stay out of prison in the future when they get out. So I think there are possibly indirect benefits.
It's been termed corollary benefits, and just like in drug studies or any other type of biomedical studies, investigators like to say, well, you know, they're getting this ancillary benefit because they're being seen by the coordinator every other week. It's the extra care that they're getting, even though that's never really been proven that they actually get that benefit. But investigators like to bring that up, that that's an extra benefit. And it may be so, but... What's that?
But the subjects actually point out that they think they get more close monitored.
Yeah.
And for behavioral research, I think I agree with you. I think the argument sometimes may seem specious in a biomedical research context, but things about process, you know, basically behavioral research about the process.
Okay, yeah, no, I like that point. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
And if someone's incarcerated for a long time, it could lead to changes within their particular prison sort of.
Well, for sure, for future populations.
So I actually, you know, 1 and 2, I didn't have that much trouble with as much as I did with.
And it's similar to the children regs, where you could do anything on children as long as it's no more than minimal risk and you have parents' consent, right? Right? You could do anything with children as long as you have parents' consent and it's no more than minimal risk, which is obviously another vulnerable group. So now, 3 and 4... I guess 3 is where research on conditions particularly affecting prisoners as a class, and I guess this is where we get into the issue where, well, maybe it could be done on other folks as well, but could we still weave a story where maybe because they're prisoners and they have this illness and maybe there's an interaction going on between being prisoners and the illness that may differ from how they respond to the illness, if you're thinking about the social determinants of health, that maybe there's an interaction going on where if you studied the same illness in another population, the results might differ, and hence there is a rationale to doing it on the prisoner population because of their nutritional basis in prisons, which is probably just a cut above hospital food or something like that. And
let's take the big one: coercive, unsafe sex.
Okay. All right. Yeah. What other population, right? I guess you could find one, but
you could probably in institutions, other kinds of institutions.
Yeah.
But my issue with 3 and 4 really was the community engagement part, because discussion with certain enumerated experts and publication of a notice in a federal register to me doesn't sort of get to who represents the interests of the prison population.
Okay, good. So what would you add to that?
I would actually add figuring out some scope of serious engagement of both, I don't say leaders in the prison community, but spokespeople within the prison community.
They're prisoners.
Prisoners, advocates.
Okay.
I'm sure there are defense lawyers who, have and other social services that provide services for prisoners. But really figure out, engage people from within those communities and try to figure out whether this particular research is going to be beneficial.
Well, they actually do. Any research that involves prisoners has to have a prisoner representative, and it's usually somebody who's a social worker that goes into prisons, somebody like that. So they actually, they don't have a, I think it would be great if you could have prisoner representative.
It's the public defender's office.
I don't doubt that individual research studies, some better designed ones as opposed to not so well designed ones, that there are appropriate individuals involved. But if I just look at the regulations, it's a little bit pro forma as to, hey, as long as we have these people and we publish this notice, we're good. There isn't, again, a philosophical bent toward let's meaningfully engage meaningful representatives from within that particular community.
So you would want a prisoner, would a prisoner be the only person you consider meaningful?
I actually provided some categories if you listened to my prior comments.
Oh, sorry, I was.
So prisoners' advocates.
Right, prisoners' advocates. What I'm saying is, would you count the public counsel? Defenders or
yes,
as that?
Yes, okay. Not just one or two.
Right.
A combination.
I actually share your concerns, the same thing about community engagement, because I feel that the prison institution is built to protect non-incarcerated individuals. That's the purpose of it. And so in some ways, it's sort of like a conflict of interest when they're there to represent the prisoners, because they've never been incarcerated and they don't know that internalized process that the prisoners go through. So there is a sort of conflict of interest of having more representation of people who are from the non-incarcerated population than those who are from the incarcerated population. So I agree that there should be more prisoner representation.
Let me just say that prisoner, to be fair to the drafters of the prisoner regulations, these regulations were written in 19 extra credit for anyone who knows the answer.
80.
What?
79.
Right. So to be fair, okay. All right. Is there an extra pretzel over there in the kitchen? What's that?
But they were revised in 2009.
Well, there's revisions and then there's revisions. Maybe they added a colon to it, but I don't think the prisoner regulations have been really changed since 1979. In fact, a few years ago, I was reading where they thought that it has been unfair, these restrictions on prisoners, and they wanted to open it up more, ease the restrictions, but I don't know what happened with that.
Applebaum wrote about that a little bit.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, right, right. Just as a historical fact, after World War II, where was 95% of pharmaceutical phase one studies being conducted? And you could guess by my tone and the reason why I'm asking this question what the answer is. 95% of phase one studies, pharmaceutical companies had their laboratories on the prison grounds. They were doing it on prisoners. And it was widely accepted by society. They thought that this would give prisoners an opportunity to pay back their debt to society. In fact, during the Nuremberg trials, the Nazi defense was, why are you, harping over us doing experiments on prisoners when you were doing the same thing on prisoners in the U.S., doing all these cholera experiments and stuff like that. And so so prisoner research was like in vogue in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s until the 70s when the start of it was when you had the Attica riots in upstate New York and people started to realize, maybe conditions in prisons are really not that good. Why else would they riot? And people started to think about that. Prisoners don't have their rights. They live in deplorable conditions, and maybe it would be either coercive or undue inducement to get these prisoners to participate in research, which is really similar to what's happening in developing countries. One is enrolling patients who are in desperate conditions. And I think Zion makes a point out of that. So getting back to the what I wanted to say. So on in category three, why is there no clause about minimal risk? In one and two, the first two categories, you have the minimal risk, and because there's no compensating benefit there, right? Except for some behavior psychotherapy type of thing, but so in one and two there's no compensating direct benefit, so you have to restrict the research to minimal risk. In three there could be a compensating benefit that hopefully offsets any risks of the study, right? And then in four, you have the pretty much the same thing, but now you have control groups, in which case there's no limitation on minimal risk, but you could have people in control groups in which there's no compensating benefit, and in that group you have to kick it up to the level of the secretary to decide whether it's ethically to do. Now, the only reason why, before we get to the larger issue of developing countries and prisoners, the only point I want to make is the we talk about vulnerable groups and core safeguards, additional safeguards. The regulations, the U.S. regulation says something like whenever you're dealing with vulnerable populations, make sure you have some additional safeguards, right? And guess what? They never mention what those safeguards are. So what are additional safeguards? Well, one additional safeguard is you limit the risk to minimal risk. Thinking that if you're enrolling vulnerable groups and they really don't want to be in the trial, but they're in the trial because they're desperate or they don't have rights or freedoms, well, you could do that, but make sure they're not going to suffer anything more than minimal risk, okay? And other safeguards would be having a consent auditor, having a person to represent the vulnerable person throughout the trial, so that person could withdraw the vulnerable person from the trial at any point. Now, it seems like Zion is saying, is looking at the safeguard from the opposite point of view, or from a different point of view. Instead of limiting the risk, Zion is saying, let's make sure that these benefits are going to be really meaningful to them. Right? Is that fair to say? Because Zion doesn't talk about minimal risk, right? Doesn't say anything about minimal risk. They're really concerned about making sure that the benefits are specific to them, right? And so, so you're enrolling vulnerable subjects, and I think they mentioned that kind of like informed consent might be out the door. Right, pretty much. So, like, even if the population has rationally decided, it's still not informed consent. It's still not valid consent. Why is that? They mentioned something like even if they decide with full rationality, it's still not valid consent. Why is that? Does that make sense?
Because the conditions for consent have to exist. Rationality assumes that you're sort of making the choice in an ideal world where you have sort of, in Zion's terms, that you have to have some basic rights. So you have to have the freedom to make that choice. And you may live in conditions that limit your ability to do that.
Okay, it limits your ability to say no, right? There's a restriction on absolute choice, right? There is.
Rationalism,
I mean,
has that sort of focusing on irrational consent, I think, assumes conditions and ideal conditions of consent. So that may or may not exist.
Well, I mean, you could be rational and unfree.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right? So,
prisoner.
Like, for example, like last week, I was working late at the hospital, okay? And I was walking, you know, to my garage for the car, right? And someone came up to me and pointed a gun to my head and said, your money or your life, okay? And so that person gave me all the information I needed to know, right? There was full disclosure, right? And even though it was late at night, I still had some sense of rationality, and I was able to also appreciate the condition I was in, right? Those are the hallmarks of informed consent. Full disclosure, understanding, appreciation, and rationality, right? And guess what choice I made? Yeah, I gave him the money.
Right. That was a rational choice.
What?
That was a rational choice.
Exactly right. Was it a free choice? No way. Right? No way would I give anybody my money. And if you doubt that, you could ask my children. But anyway. So I wasn't free to say no. And now, I guess, is it... So on one hand, I guess you could say, well, if that's the case, if there's no free choice, then let's forget about doing any research on vulnerable groups, right? Now, what does science say to that?
Before we go there, I just want to bring up one point, if I may, and that's sort of the way that they try to define sort of the vulnerable population within their sort of context around power relationships and so on and so forth. You could make the argument that there are very few groups that are not, any groups anywhere in any time in any situation that are not involved in some sort of power-like relationship. And, you know, taken to a nihilistic perspective, you could say then under those circumstances, no such thing as informed consent at all, anywhere, at any time.
I agree with you, but I think it's on one hand, it's good to aspire to an ideal concept of informed consent, and I agree with you. You don't get there, so it's a threshold type of situation, and just like determining capacity in the medical arena, and also there was an article written by Frank Miller and stating that the informed consent should be like a sliding scale. The extent to which you think you have full, valid informed consent should be somewhat linked to the risk of the study. That if it's minimal risk, then, you know, how much informed consent do you really need? For something that's really risky, and if the IRB has approved it, then you would want a higher standard for informed consent. There is that sliding scale notion, and we use that in determining competency in the medical arena. So if someone wants to refuse their screening colonoscopy, we don't haul in the psychiatrist to assess competency. We say, okay, we'll see you next year. However, if someone wants to refuse the ventilator, we're going to ask a lot of questions to make sure that that patient has a higher standard of competency, or what. Going to want to be more certain about that person's, that patient's competency. If we're dealing with, so Zion does make this move to say that people in developing countries should be looked upon somewhat similar as prisoners. I guess before we go on, do you agree with that? Or is that being too unkind to people in the developing world? Are we being, what? They're like prisoners? I mean, is that politically incorrect? Or what the heck is going on here? Or should they be considered?
There was an article we read for the class prior to this by Levine, Fadden, Grady, Hammerschmidt, Eckenweiler, always so many people in these articles, about the limitations of vulnerability as a protection
So they were arguing for a broader definition of vulnerability, meaning everyone in this room could be vulnerable under certain situations.
It's a situational approach as opposed to a class approach.
And I found that particularly convincing because it got away from putting sort of people in boxes. You're vulnerable as a pregnant woman, you're vulnerable as a child.
Right.
Rather than creating conditions where consent is meaningful and taking into account, it was more of a context specific, and there are three recommendations. I think one was the research design itself should take into account, should be sort of a well-designed research question and take into account sort of context-specific research. I get the other two recommendations. I don't have the article in front of me right now. But going back to Zion's sort of point, it's really, rather than assuming that ideal conditions for consent exist and informed consent is the same all throughout, and therefore hang our hat on informed consent or notions like minimal risk, really dig deeper and find out what conditions do exist. Inform yourselves about, if you don't know, if you're the IRB person or whoever, inform yourself as to what conditions exist, or if you're the researcher, inform yourself as to what conditions do exist. And within your ability, try to create conditions for a sort of minimally exploitative, if not, minimally exploitative research. So I'm not so troubled about the categorization. I mean, I didn't read Zion's article as categorizing people in the developing country exactly like prisoners, more like, let's take a broader view of vulnerability and look at conditions that exist that make certain people vulnerable at certain moments.
Okay, so considering the context of the developing world and they're lacking basic rights and freedoms, pick your country in the developing world. So Zion is concerned about doing research on individuals who lack basic rights and freedom. So is the answer let's not do any research?
No.
Why not?
Well, because then they never benefit. I mean, they make the argument that it has to be that research has to be dealing with things that are inherent in the population, and if they could never participate, they'd never get the benefit.
Right. They would not reap the benefits of research, and if anything, you can't have health without good research. And you can't have good research without good research ethics. But so they're saying let's not deny them the benefits of research, but let's restrict it to the inherent characteristics of their situation, of their health situation, which means this very restrictive approach.
But I think that they're even more restrictive than that.
What's that?
I think they're even more restrictive than what you just said. The research itself should directly address real health needs thought to be important by the subject.
There's a whole
value judgment that comes into this.
What do you mean? Value judgment.
Well, particularly in contrast to the prison population and prison regs. This says you can. It's not just it's not just characteristics that are inherent to the population. It's characteristics that are inherent to the population that are also felt by that population to be important.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
And that's raising the bar even higher.
Yes. I'm going to make an assumption here that if these same individuals wanted to rewrite the prisoner regulations now in 2012, they would probably add that. Because getting back to the community engagement, I think the I mean, you can't have external people trying to decide what are the health needs of the population. So I agree with you totally. Yeah.
John? So I just wanted to use this as a kind of a point of departure to discuss the difference between regulations and ethics.
Right, yes, and, good.
In some sense, the regulations provide a floor of very procedurally oriented kind of things that you can easily implement. You have a prison rep on the IRB. If they put in this, they started to get at some of the things. Because the guidances, if you look at the guidances, look at Helsinki and Siam's and other stuff, especially the commentary, it's very rich and detailed, but you'd never want a regulation to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, a regulation has to really kind of defer
specific.
And leave it up to others to kind of like make the ethical judgment. So this thing is just, it's trying to inform people's decision-making about implementing regulations. So I would hope that they would never get rewrite things. I mean, I'm just thinking of the emergency regulations. So the emergency regulations are very procedure oriented again. I said, you know, you have to make a determination that the existing therapies are insufficient, right? And then you have hoops to judge jump through.
Right.
And you have to kind of like you have to have a community. You have to reach out to the community and try to engage them somehow. They don't say how, right? Which is somewhat problematic for implementation.
Yeah, but those regs are not really trying to fit the model of community participatory research. It's mainly informing them.
Right. But it is, it's the only regulation that I know of in this area that kind of like says you have to go out and try to engage the community at some level.
Right, yeah, right. And it takes ethics to build in the real participatory part of it, right. So the other when are we taking a break? I need a break.
We can take a break.
The other point to make: have they read any of Alex London's articles about the human development approach to research?
No.
Okay.
At least not because of me.
Oh, right. Okay. All right. So there's this concept that Alex London writes about the human development approach to research, and he says that pretty much almost the same thing, but taken from a different angle, that the only research that should be done on populations in the developing world is that type of research that is going to lead to real human development. So what does that mean, and is this similar to what Zion is talking about? In terms of what type of research to be done on the developing world populations,
does he offer any specifics, or is it just very open and leaves it up to say researchers or the reader to define?
Oh well, he actually does give some examples.
Okay,
and you know he does. Categorize certain types of research as the minimalistic approach, mm-hmm. and then you have the human development approach. How would you interpret a human development approach to research? In the
maybe educational somehow in nature, or
I guess
if it's an intervention study, or
what does it mean to you have the United Nations Human Development Index and Millennium Goals and trying to enhance human development of a population, and what does it mean to Well, I mean, what does that mean? Human development. Amartya Sen has written the book "Development as Freedom." What does all that has to do with research? What does it mean to have development or capabilities to lead a well-functioning life?
So it's almost like focusing away from why research is conducted in the first place, which is to answer some sort of scientific question, and really refocusing it on what is this scientific question, how is it going to sort of benefit or lead to the progressive development of the people among whom the research is being conducted. So it's not just, you know, let's do this research because it'll lead to a scientifically interesting result, but let's not leave communities worse off. Let's actually try to leave communities better off. So maybe frame research questions that have more of a specific human development or development goal in mind overall, and designing research studies in ways that overall enhance in some form or another, because of the presence of the research study in a particular community, enhance the, in a sustainable way, the conditions in that community in the long run.
When I did behavioral research, we called it a win-win.
A win-win?
Yeah. So we answered the scientific question, but the community as a whole benefited as well. So it was kind of like a product of the study, basically. So a real win-win, that's what I'm thinking of.
Okay, yeah.
I guess is what it comes down to what you mean by development, and in whose eyes what that development is, whether that's specific to the community you're talking about, more globally, more regionally, or so on. Because people can sort of define, you know, the issue about development. People are looking at it from a, you know, developed world perspective. They call it T3, translational research, if you may. You know, would be, you know, developmental sort of research in the developed world. But it may have a different context. Well, it would probably have the same context in the quote non-developed world. You know, how does it have an, how does the, you know, the study you're doing have impact in the, you know, impact on health in the real world? And there's obviously a lot of stuff that has to come before that. But different, it's consistent, I guess, with what I was trying to say is that it may be specific to an individual population or an individual country, but then how do you get that granular? How do you decide, you know, what are the issues within a country? Because there's different populations within a country. So it may be sort of a, you know, there are more questions to answer than you can answer, you know, than you can define. But I think that's probably where this is going. It's just very difficult to get a handle on.
Well, I mean, essentially, similar to community engagement is you let the Ministry of Health, assuming that it's non-corruptible, but that the MOH sets the research agenda for the country, assuming that the MOH knows, is well informed by the population and knows what are the high priority illnesses in that country. And in fact, recent discussions have been that HIV may not necessarily be the illness to focus on in many of these countries. And who decided in the beginning that it should be HIV? Not that HIV is not very serious, but there are other illnesses in the developing world that would lead to overall a better health outcome for the country, and health is a leading indicator of human development. And development, in Amartya Sen's view, is being able to have the choices available to lead the life that you want to lead. To have, it's a matter of being able to do things that you want to do and be people who you want to be. And that's development as freedom, the freedom to choose. And health is one of those one of those freedoms, or contributes to one of those freedoms to decide. So in the both London and I would assume Zion as well, they consider that the health agenda is very important. Now, if you do research on diabetes, I mean, you could get the same answer by doing that research in the developed world. And the problem, and London makes this case very well, there's, because in the developing world, there's a so much capacity that the country has to do research in terms of the number of clinical sites, the number of research coordinators, the number of minus 70 degree refrigerators that they have in that country. So so if you're going to do research in the developing world, and hence there's a limit to the capacity on the extent of what research you could do, wouldn't it be really good if you limit it to the research that really affects illnesses inherent to that population as decided by that population, and let all the diabetes research be done in the developed world? And how else would that research be done?
Well, what if diabetes is different, you know, in different parts of the world because of, again, their environment or their diet or so on and so forth? The same argument it was made around HIV or pediatrics or whatever. So
Right. That's a great question to ask, but and the same thing that if a drug is approved in the Western population, it may not act the same in the population in the developing world. But I guess if
That will work more with research involving, let's say, diabetes that looks at the conditions, something other than a drug-related intervention to controlling diabetes.
Well,
we suppose that the Ministry of Health in a developing country full of vulnerable people isn't going to say their number one priority is diabetes and finding new drugs. I mean, if you're going to play this game out, you have to presuppose that a community can make a choice for something that we've identified as first world therapies as being a priority. You can't have this both ways.
Well, I guess my concern would be that the how do you know when you have ideal conditions for choice? The other thing that London talks about is that you have this race to the bottom phenomenon, whereas if the only research that is being offered to the developing countries is diabetes research, pharmaceutical companies are going to keep on, shopping around to the countries that will finally say, okay, we want this research no matter what, because it will create jobs, it will build some infrastructure for research, but it doesn't really get at the at the what we really need, and the concern is that the and this other philosopher economist talks about this, Thomas Pogge, about that the whole incentive system for pharmaceutical research is really upside down, in the sense that pharmaceutical companies are only going to offer research in which they could charge a lot of money. And guess what? Who's going to pay a lot of money for the drugs? It's going to be the Western countries. And hence, pharmaceutical companies is only going to be shopping around for doing research on their diabetes drugs. So on one hand, I agree with you. The MOH may say, okay, let's do these this diabetes trial. But guess what? That's the only thing being offered. No one's offering research on
entire countries.
What's that?
Who's going to decide that entire countries are not able to exercise reasoned, free choice about what they want? Who's going to make that determination? If you track out this notion that in the race to the bottom, that there are people at the bottom who have no choice but to accept, who is going to make the decision that they can't exercise that choice?
Well, it's I guess the issue is what kind of a choice it is when the only alternatives are research on diabetes, hypertension, and other illnesses, in which the research could be done on less vulnerable groups.
I'm simply playing the devil's advocate.
Right,
which
sure.
Which is that if we're talking about the importance of communities, which is a class distinction that I have trouble with from the get-go, because not everybody is as equally vulnerable in a community. But if you take that position, that communities should be able to make a determination, then you have to also protect their right to make a bad choice.
Right, but then we have to understand that, I agree with you, but then we have to understand what it means to have a choice. And when do you have a real choice? And so to borrow from another related field, the obesity epidemic, people talk about, do individuals in these impoverished communities, do they have a real choice in the food that they could buy? And you talk about these food deserts in which the only food available to them is McDonald's. So they could have a choice to either eat McDonald's or, what's the alternative?
Not eat.
What?
Not eat.
Okay. And it gets even more complicated with the notion of choice, because now they're coming up with studies showing, okay, let's haul in the Paneras and the other so-called good restaurants, and let's haul in the supermarkets that sells vegetables and fruits and all that. And guess what? What do they choose? That's right. They still choose McDonald's. And why is that? What? No, let's say the price is the same even. Let's say the price is less for the vegetables. And so, and this is, I mean, I only raise this to bring up the issue of what gets into choice. And part of the reason why they're still choosing McDonald's is because behind choices is also, what's happening in your environment, in the social, social, psychosocial environment, who's advocating for vegetables? If you buy a vegetable, is your peer group gonna, you know, hang on you for eating a carrot, okay, when you should be eating McDonald's? And there was a recent study done about in the office that, you know, if you're, you know, it's kind of like, you know, there's more cake and candy and stuff like that going around the office that even if there are vegetables, you know, you may get, you know, ranked on for not eating the cake or something like that. So it all goes behind, you know, this concept of social capital. Who's advocating for the vegetables? I mean, where are the parents? Where are the neighbors? And in those communities in which people have taken back the communities and have really advocated for, you know, it's cool to eat your carrot, okay, that's when the choice comes in. So it all gets behind the whole concept of when do people have a choice. And, you know, I agree with you. If the NIH decides they want to do the diabetes drug trial, that's fine. But I'm just concerned about the choice. Is there a real choice?
I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm going beyond that, which is who decides the Ministry of Health is operating without choices?
Oh, okay. Well,
practical about this.
Well, but let's make sure that let's make sure that there is a healthy agenda on the table for them to make a choice. Now, and you could say, how do you know when you have a healthy agenda on the table? I agree with you, but right now, if you look at the number of recently approved drugs, only 3% has dealt with illnesses in the developing world. Only 3%, and it's all and Poggi makes the argument that don't blame the drug companies; they're just going by how they're being incentivized to make the drugs. I mean, essentially, and especially with the patent agreements, the whole incentive system is for them only to make drugs that are responsive to the health needs, primarily, of the developed world, or to the exclusion of the illnesses of the developing world. And one final thought before we take a break is that he suggests that the patent system or the way that drug companies should get remunerated for their research should be linked to the impact that the drugs have on populations. Right now, it's to the benefit of drug companies to make drugs that doesn't cure people, but only you know, relieve the symptoms and keep them alive longer and longer. Okay, not to cure, because who makes the vaccines in the world? Who? I mean, it's not mainly drug companies.
Right.
It's what's that?
No, it's not mainly.
Right? Yeah, because that's a one-shot deal. I mean, drug companies have no interest. I mean, some of them do, but mainly they don't. So if you link the reimbursement system to the impact, meaning how many millions of people you cure of an illness, then you'll have drug companies making drugs for the developing world. The only flaw in that argument is that you have to set up some kind of public fund in order to, you know, being able to reimburse the drug company. So I agree with you. How do you know when you finally have a valid choice on the platter? But right now it seems like the only choice is diabetes drugs and hypertension drugs, and very little in terms of tropical diseases. So that's why Zion is saying, if you do something, and London as well, if you do something that leads to real human development for that developing country, then, and maybe, as Zion said, only then could you think about doing research on vulnerable individuals who lack basic rights and freedoms. Yeah, okay, good. All right.
6 minutes, 7 minutes.
Okay. This lasts till 7? Okay, good. We'll come back and we'll get less heavy and we'll talk about cases.
Okay. All right. I'm glad you invoked Bodhi.
What's that?
I'm glad you invoked this stuff because it really is ironic, especially my take on this paper is in a very strict reading is that it is, you know, it's going to be a characteristic of the population to justify doing research. That means you're going to be looking at just as much as these other kind of crazy, you know, neglected diseases of the South and not diabetes and not things that we share with them. Even though the total burden of health is greater than diabetes and heart disease.
One is not going to minimize the burden of heart disease and diabetes
But you could allow it if the community recognizes it as a legitimate health need.
Yeah, but they really bear.
But that's my concern. I mean, as someone who I spent some of my year in a very remote village in Costa Rica, and in Costa Rica, a rapidly developing country, where many of the health concerns that are affecting people now are actually a cause of development because diet has changed dramatically.
Well, you're talking about a particular type of development.
Correct. Yeah. But if you came in and said to people, well, is it important to you that we investigate how to prevent obesity because obesity is occurring because now, you know, there's fresh meat coming in here three times a week instead of once every other week, and people are eating much more meat, and they're not cultivating their own stuff, and they're not fishing as much, all of which is true. People would say, no, we like, you know, it's great that the meat truck comes three times a week now. What are you kidding me? You're going to do something which makes it less likely that that would happen, or says that's a bit.
You know, and having said that, there's, not every obesity research that's done in the Western world is necessarily generalizable to what's happening in the developing world. So at some point, you want to do that.
Do it when you come back. You really can't. That's their way of trying to.
No, not really. I mean, there was.
Even though we're trying to deadline.
It was one, I wish I had made copies. Could I make a, print out from my flash drive? Why don't we do it that way?
I share your concern because of something that happened about the urban, more affluent, but whatever they said today. While that would be a concern, if it was asked in a different way, it's not as if people are not concerned, they do want to understand the relationship to heart disease or diabetes. What I'm seeing happening now, this is also an advantage, is that there's like over-prescription of cholesterol medication and diabetes medication. With very little discussion and knowledge about what are the causes of these diseases?
Yeah.
Some people will always have them.
It's like,
but what are other ways for people who are interested in this program?
There's a lot of stuff here.
So, choose to something that you rather than use. But
people want to change the behavior.
I don't know, but if I am
going
to say
I don't get the sense that people want to change the behavior. I get to believe there must be some people who want to change the behavior. We hire all human beings everywhere the same. Some will always take an easy way, and some people will have to figure out the harder way.
I'm not saying that.
That just doesn't sort of exist. So there aren't any studies that I think of that are related more to what you just said, how conditions have changed, or heart disease studies. Those would be really encouraging. I would think encouraged rather than, hey, here's this new pill for something else that you have. Don't change anything about yourself. Just take the pill.
Right. Well, I guess my ultimate point is that there's an element of what you might classify as paternal.
Yeah, of course. That's what Francis was trying to point out.
And it seems to me it's very, very difficult to decry paternalism and say, well, we have to let the community decide on the one hand, and then at the same time be talking about, well, we can't let this happen and this happen and this happen because we've decided the basic rights don't exist here.
No, so to me it's more like saying, let's have a conversation about the assumption that you're going to see what you know and know what you're going to do. And I said, seriously, well, I first came up issues about commitment daily, and I come from a day, and I'm Muslim, so it's somewhere I don't know why I said Then I have to question, there are studies available. There are public health
schools like
academics or other communities, maybe community of doctors, clinicians, or whatever. Let's get everyone on the table and see, like, is that what it just comes from our minds, or is it really,
and so
it's more like that rather than, hey, there's a scale, MOH wants to study, and we, because, oh, it's easier, cheaper, just to like all these issues. There must be a happy meeting.
Sometimes the community don't know what they want. Like the example he has given, that you have these people who are having fights and they are enjoying that meat. The meats are coming, trucks are coming, but they are enjoying
it.
But they don't know that they are being exposed in a certain
process. In that culture, that might be a good
thing.
I think that aren't there some African countries where the larger people are considered wealthy? You know what I mean? So culturally, they may not see a problem.
There's never a category.
He was trying to just find that this make the European world be among the vulnerable population, but he doesn't compare them like prisoners. Prisoners are being compared like vulnerable population. Is how the development world has been compared like vulnerable.
And you know what? If the community knew they would be considered like prisoners, I don't know if they would. You know what I mean? It doesn't seem.
Actually, right. So if you say that way, it means we also take children as prisoners. Also, pregnant women as prisoners. We have those people at the emergency. We also we put them as prisoners. I think that is
not right.
So actually, the main point where we look is vulnerable population, where all this going to enter. Prisoners will fall in that. at them some parameter, make them poor into the vulnerable population. The same the developing windows at some aspects, make them be among the vulnerable population. But not as a prison.
And actually, it's also their perspective.
Yeah.
You know, it's like coming from here, looking down.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, and the issue is sometimes you might think that this is a problem.
Right.
And you don't see the problem.
So you really didn't get robbed last week?
No. I only get robbed every time I talk about informed consent.
Okay. Very good. Just a check.
Yes, right.
Yeah, I lived in Baltimore for 3 years. I didn't actually get robbed, but my car did get broken into quite a few times.
Right, yeah. Same here, too. Yeah. But,
that's a right of passage,
though. So why don't we talk about the hepatitis E vaccine trial? Since I think at one point John wanted me to say a few words about IRBs in the developing world, or should I just wait for him to come back at some point?
So we were interested in sort of the calculus that as IRBs set themselves up in the Middle East, not the Middle East in general, but in the developing world countries, what concepts of vulnerability they might have had that would be similar or different to what we would have thought of. Are they setting up guidelines to protect prisoners, pregnant women, fetuses, and children? Are they defining vulnerability in a broader context? Are they having the kinds of considered debates that we're having about what is vulnerability?
Right. Well, are they having the type of conversations that we just had? No. I guess, they're just, struggling with basic issues as having getting the basic needs necessary to have an IRB, struggling with being recognized, that the IRB is important, is necessary. They're struggling with issues where investigators are questioning, why do I have to send my study to another committee? And there's real concerns on several levels. One, like a lot of research that's being done is in the university level, where in order to like a physician, they go to medical school right after high school for 6 years, and then after that they go for a master's level and then the PhD level, and they have to submit research, a thesis, and there's no funding for research, so many times the funding comes out of their own pocket, and they'll be damned, to have a IRB turn down their research and also delay research because the clock is ticking for promotion. So there's a lot of concerns about submitting research to the IRBs. Also, there's an interesting concept about how you could have well-trained IRB members, but if you live in a corrupt environment, you're not going to have good ethics review because For example, a lot of investigators are concerned that they don't want to submit their protocols to the IRB because the they're concerned that researchers on the IRB will steal their ideas. You know, a lot of plagiarism going on. Also, there's a lot of concern that the I've heard so many stories where members on the IRB doesn't approve research because they don't want the investigator to get ahead. One set of researchers or people investigating this are linking the functioning of IRBs to the corruption index in the country. I mean, hasn't come up with real. I mean, all this is theoretical, but functioning of an IRB may very well depend on the social, economic, political environment of the country. I will tell you that in Egypt. After they had their, if you want to call it now, a revolution, after Mubarak was overthrown, this concept of rights was very much in the atmosphere, and on one hand, patients started. Exerting their rights, started questioning investigators. So, like, now, tell me, why did you get that? Why did you take that extra sample of blood from me? Okay, where previously patients would never question that because doctors know best, or I don't want to tick off my doctor because he or she may not treat me well. Also, on the other hand, investigators started to be very responsive to patients' concerns because they figured that if the people could overthrow Mubarak, then maybe they're next. Okay, and in fact, after the revolution, there was wholesale changes in the deanships and the presidents of many universities, especially people who had ties to Mubarak. So people started to get concerned about not being accountable. So there were some changes, but by and large, there's a lot of concerns about being a functioning IRB. In an environment where corruption is rampant, and ethics is still not well, legitimized as an important field. A few years ago, they made the requirement in the universities in Egypt that in order to be promoted, you have to have at least one article in an international journal. And guess what? In order to have that, you have to have, have had ethics review for publication in an international journal. So then came the requirement that all universities have to start having plans for an IRB in order to give ethics review and approval, and of course to do federally funded research, you need to have an IRB. Now, I've seen universities in which the only reason why an IRB was formed in order to prove that one NIH grant that this one investigator got in the university, and after that there was no IRB. In fact, if you look on the OHRP website, if you look at the IRBs that have been registered with OHRP, you see a long list of deactivated IRBs, meaning IRBs that, you're supposed to renew your IRB registration every 3 years with OHRP. So obviously, if you only formed an IRB to review one protocol, you know, after 3 years, there's no reason to, you know, re-register with OHRP. So there's a long list of deactivated IRBs on the OHRP website. Now, in terms of having discussions about vulnerability, at least I hope that the people who have gone through the training program that I direct, I hope they have healthy discussions about vulnerability. I guess what I'm saying is that they're still struggling with other issues about who's taking minutes, which is usually the chairperson. I have this one person who said, you know, Henry, I'm struggling with this IRB, and I'm writing up the minutes till 2 o'clock in the morning. Maybe there's a disincentive to have long discussions. I don't know. While you were out, I was talking about, I knew you wanted me to say something about IRBs in the developing world, but I'm not sure exactly.
What was your experience with them in their growth and...
Yeah, I'll find.
We've seen this in Africa.
Yeah. Right. Now, I'm sure it's the same in all the developing regions. Let me say that in the last 5 to 10 years, IRBs have been formed, constituted, and then now the next step is how do you know they're functioning? How do you know they're functioning well? And now here in the U.S., only recently we have this accreditation system, which is voluntary, but everyone has bought into it. But there's no external review throughout.
Is it AHRQ?
Yeah, AHRQ, right. My concern is that you get a group together around this table, they formed an IRB, and now what? Now what do we do? You know, we have a protocol. You know, what do we do for that? On one hand, it's a little disconcerting that you wonder about the functioning of the IRBs, but on the other hand, how long has it taken us to form good functioning IRBs? It's what, 30, 40 years? And sometimes we still haven't gotten it right. Now, on the other hand, people say we have too much bureaucracy in the IRBs, and which is true. The short answer is that it's going to take time, and I think we're making inroads. I think good people are being trained, and they're getting buy-in from the top. Gradually, slowly. I've met IRBs personnel in which they say, only seniors could be on the IRBs. We don't take juniors. So even though I've trained juniors, they're not on the IRBs because they have this hierarchy where only seniors could be. And, you know, I looked at the vice dean and I said to him, you know, if the juniors don't get any experience, what's going to happen when, you're not here anymore, okay? Especially when I told you the retirement age is 60. Well, actually, they could still serve on IRBs after 60. In fact, the a lot of chairmen of IRBs are the professor emeritus, and... You know, everybody wants to be the chair of an ethics committee because that's a good thing. You know, I'm the chair of the ethics committee, but mainly those professors have no training. And it's the younger people who have the training, but you know, their voice is subdued.
Dr. Silverman, in your experience with these IRBs, off the record, would you be willing to say like whether there are differences in how IRBs should be constituted and how they should function in the countries that you've had exposure to? Differences from how a U.S. IRB works?
No, not really, because the basic structure of IRB should be, people should have the training, at least 5 members, no more than 15, 20, because then you'll never reach consensus. And I think the basic structure of IRBs in the U.S. is, or in Europe, Australia, Canada, I think is generalizable to any way that I think the way we make ethics decisions I think is a universal, multi-representation. I like the idea of a non-scientist, non-affiliated community person. If anything, a lot of IRBs in the U.S. don't have enough of those type of folks. So I think the model, is transportable to the developing country. But as I said before, you could have that structure, but if you're working in a certain political climate, it's not going to work. And I think that's the harder nut to crack.
Or maybe a more optimistic view would be if you have an IRB that does work, you have a committee that actually makes ethics decisions that could actually serve as an example for other types of committees to solve other types of issues within a particular context. That's my optimistic take on it. It's a model.
Yeah, right. And I think the but it's happening. I mean there are several IRBs that I would be happy with their processes. Just today I heard from my trainees about how a member of the IRB turned down research because he was annoyed that he wasn't invited to participate in the research. What kind of stuff is that? I don't know. Maybe that happens here. So what do you think about this hepatitis E vaccine trial? Do you think it? This is a chance to apply what we've all been discussing to real cases. So, concerns about subject selection and the hepatitis E vaccine trial. So who were the subjects?
The Nepal Army.
Okay, all right. Any concerns with that?
It is an armed force, but it's not a well-structured armed force, I can at least say. And so a lot of power imbalances on top of the already imbalance of a military structure. Would make it a vulnerable situation for this population.
Power imbalances. Okay. All right. Not only within the military, but also
tied into, their training of and the corruption. I mean, the possible corrupt nature of a smaller, a different kind of regime than compared to the United States.
Okay. There's power imbalance in the military here, but at least we have a notion of civil rights.
Yeah.
And maybe people in the military here could refuse, maybe, at least more so than in Nepal. Okay. What else contributes to the... if you think the Nepal army is vulnerable, what else contributes to their vulnerability?
They say that they are poor and possibly illiterate.
Okay.
The way it reads.
Right. So how does that contribute to their vulnerability? I mean, what does poor has to do with making decisions?
I mean, making decisions that may be based on the fact of economic necessity, as opposed to just informed consent on a level where they can actually make an informed consent, where their economic disadvantage outweighs their ability to...
Well, how does the economic play into informed consent?
Well, if there's some incentive, perhaps, that's provided by the study.
Okay. Or if they think they're going to lose their job.
Indeed.
If they say no.
Yes.
They get kicked out of the military and then they... lose their job. Okay. All right. Or if they say no.
I don't think
so. What's that? No, I don't think so. Yeah, right. No. We don't pay military to join trials, right? I don't think they were given an incentive. What do you think? Is this a, after saying all that, is this a study that responds to an inherent characteristic of the population?
Is the Nepal Army one of the three provinces in that area that's affected by hepatitis B? I didn't notice that whether or not that was the case in the write-up.
Right. Yeah. It's it's endemic there. So it appears that it's affecting an inherent characteristic of the population, but I guess what else? Might you be concerned about the? So this vaccine may be responsive to their needs. So what's the other piece to the puzzle? It's responsive to their needs, but also responsive to who else needs?
Well, the researchers, because they were chosen by default, because their original plan fell through.
The researchers? I mean, who else might benefit from the hepatitis E vaccine?
Pregnant women.
Army.
What's that?
U.S.
Yeah, the U.S. Army, right. So I guess the concern, and we talked about this a little bit early on, is it going to be made reasonably available to the communities in Nepal? So what do you think? Should this research be done? You're the IRB. I think we've had a good discussion already. It's time for a vote, guys. What do you think?
I just have a question.
You're always having too many questions. Go ahead.
My question is, does joining the military make them capable of protecting their own interests? Because they join the military in order to for economic benefit. So does that make them capable? Even though
Well, in terms of, what do you mean?
Just inherently capable of protecting their own interests, because that's one of the...
Well, as we mentioned before, if they have a concern they're going to lose their job, then the, you know, how voluntary is that? If they're going to lose their job, if they think they're going to lose their job.
But joining the military because they need the economic benefits from the military, does that constitute a capability of protecting their interests? Because they join the military because of what it provides for them?
Tell me more what you're thinking, because...
Well, in the case, it said something about that the soldiers joined because they saw it as a benefit. They saw it as the economic, the pay and...
Sure, right.
So does that constitute capability of protecting their interests?
Well, again, if they think that... If they say no, they would be in a worse off condition. Then the answer is no. They can't. It would be hard to think that they could give voluntary consent, right? If the reason why they join is for the job, and hence, if there's a concern, just like an employer-employee situation, if the employer has this trial, the employee may feel he or she has no choice in the matter, right? Is that, or is there something else?
No, I can understand. So it sounds like what you're saying is that the country or the powers that be are setting up a situation where joining the military is the only solution, so they don't have it. They're not making a choice based on
that. Oh, well, that might be true, but then now they're in the military, and they're being asked to join this trial, and so the question is, do they have real choice? It's just like a doctor patient. Is there any patient that's not vulnerable? Is there any patient who is not in a potential coercive situation? In the hospital setting, let's just restrict it to that.
No.
I mean, when you think about it, I mean, the large answer is no. But I mean, I guess there might be ways to minimize that vulnerability. I'm sorry.
I was just going to go out on a limb and say, no, I don't think you can do this because of a consent issue. Because not only are they in the Army, but if they're not in the Army, they're indistinguishable from the population that is the subject of human rights abuses by the Army. And so the fear of losing their Army status if they refuse participation in the trial puts them at much heightened risk of really adverse consequences. So I just don't see a way that you can get informed consent here.
All right. What do you think? Tell them to do the trial in another community, or another population. They tried to do that, right, on a civilian population, and the mayor said no, right? Maybe he was up for a re-election. I don't know if they have elections. But
and his reasons were that they wouldn't promise post-trial access. So why can they run it's an end run,
right?
Very much an end run. Mm-hmm.
And there is a U.S. military base there.
Right, I guess the concern is whether it's going to be available to the indigent population. So,
is it just the indigent or anybody? There's no
commitment. Oh, well, depending on who could afford it.
Right. Which raises the question I raised earlier with the prisoners. Like, at what point do you negotiate, and who has the power to negotiate access to post-trial benefits? And it's this big open question, and it comes up in all of this research. Like, what promises have to be made, and who can negotiate on behalf of a country or anybody, any population?
Right, and you know, is it the local IRB, or do you need a well-trained IRB at the MOH level?
Is it even the IRB that can negotiate that?
Well, yeah, that's a good question too. Should it be left up to the IRB? I mean,
or should they come in hand with their plan? Here's how we're satisfying your priorities. Here's how we're going to promise post trial benefit, and then IRB then weighs that against the risk and benefit. Blah blah blah. And yes or no?
Take it
they shouldn't be negotiating now.
Would post trial benefits make a difference in whether the Army is the one that should participate in research?
I don't think so, because I think they just can't give consent.
It's a consent issue.
Yeah, I think they just can't give
consent. It's a threshold issue.
Hey, wait a minute, what about the SEAM's admonition to kind of like use a non-vulnerable population, if you could find one? I mean, this is clearly a population. You shouldn't be using it, and the reason they're doing it is because they can't get them.
Right.
Population, and that should not be a reason. Oh, well, nobody else would volunteer, so let's go to this vulnerable population.
Yeah, they should have said, okay, we'll give post-trial access to do it. They should have just agreed to do that instead of try to do an end run.
Arguably.
I think they had flawed research design from the very beginning. That's the problem. I mean,
the research design itself?
Yes.
Wasn't a standard vaccine trial?
Right, but the fact that they didn't take into account that there might be community opposition and plan for that. I mean, they're basically, my issue with the Army here is that they're basically forum shopping because they couldn't get to do the research here. So that's why they went to a captive group who had to agree. Your issue about post-study benefits, if they had thought about that and worked that into the plan, or if there was some ethical review available here, if that was required to be put into part of the plan, that would probably have ameliorated the concern for doing this research in a less vulnerable general population.
So, yes or no? I'm hearing a lot of no's.
No?
No?
Well, there is no lesser vulnerable population.
Right, this is it. This is it, right?
On the prisons.
I mean, you know, pick anybody you want, you've got a problem. I mean, it's endemic. It's one-third of the population. It's in every country, including North and South America. Go somewhere else. Or decide you can do the research in a vulnerable population because your protocol is taken into account post-trial benefits and that's part of a negotiated agreement. Or you build in safeguards for consent. You can't
do
that.
Take one and pass it down. So this trial was done on the military, and the results of the trial was published in the New England Journal. Okay, and I'm not sure if that says anything, but anyway, and after the trial was done, there was a letter to the editor, which is what I'm passing out now, and it one letter, I squared the pertinent narrative. One commentator had concerns about the consent of the soldiers, undue influence. So I think the commentator is really talking about coercion. Talks about in the second square about availability of the vaccine, and then on the second column some issues about who's going to benefit from the vaccine, and talks about the international travelers. And so on the second page we have the author's reply, okay? And in the first box it says, our trial was responsive to a national health need and adhered to international guidelines. Trial was approved by ethics panels in Nepal and the U.S. Okay. In particular, we took measures to remove the influence of military commanders over participation by their subordinates. I'm not sure what those measures were, but... they go on to say, of more than 40,000 soldiers who were informed about the trial, only 5,000 gave informed consent. And they, you know, talk about the low percentage of consent. And the high proportion that declined to participate in the study at each stage of enrollment belies coercion. Of course, we're never told about what really happened to the people who never gave consent, but that's another story.
Yeah, 5,000.
And then they talk about access to the vaccine after the trial, and we affirm that GlaxoSmithKline embraces the principle of distributive justice and is committed to continued development of the vaccine so it could be made available in Nepal. Nevertheless, since control of infectious diseases is a global public good, we call for international financing for the introduction of the vaccine through partnerships similar to developed by other vaccines. So I guess they believe in distributive justice, but they need help. Who are the other global actors to help with financing, you know, this drug for the countries, I mean for the communities in the countries? And
So it's an interesting letter
to the editors and a response, and the you know, so some people were concerned about the voluntariness of the military to give consent, and indeed it seems like a lot of people refuse consent, but I don't know where they are nowadays, but anyway. Let me just, in the few remaining minutes, I guess I'd like to just real quickly talk about the research involving street children in South Africa, and I'm going to give John the original article, and that will be posted on Blackboard, but what do you think? In concept, we have street children who are... Now, this is a big problem in the developing world because street children who lack guardians, right? I mean, with all the fighting, you've got a lot of orphans, and they're living on the streets, and they have health needs. And how do you enroll them in research? Now, this research was I'm trying to get at their health needs. So how do you enroll them in research? We're talking about age 9 to 13.
Well, SIOM says to use a community advocate or someone that's, you know, can advocate for them. So I don't know, obviously.
To give consent?
No, to work with the researchers. And I think it was under informed consent, actually. I don't have it right in front of me. But it said, I think it was guideline 15, maybe, or 14. And it did say that... with populations like that, they could have some sort of advocate to kind of guide the consent process. You know, so maybe.
But who actually gives permission?
Well, I mean, if they're living on the streets, they don't have parents. I guess they would have to give permission themselves, or the advocate could oversee the consent process and make sure the child understood. But they don't. If they don't have parents to sign off on it, then I think that they should be. I don't know if they can be considered adults, but you know, with the help of a some sort of advocate, I think they could obtain an informed consent.
Okay. So in this article, the researchers with the consultation with the community experts thought that these children are living on the streets. They're living on their own, and they're doing a good job, and hence, they could be considered emancipated minors who could give their own consent. Now, having said that, they also ascribe to the concept of someone else also participating in the process as well, because they didn't really want to go out on the full limb about saying these miners were emancipated, but they gave the miners the ability to dissent. And who did they consult in the interest of in the concept of community engagement, consultation? Who represents the community in this study? Well, and always in community participatory research, the question is, who is the community? So who is the community in this study?
The children.
Right. So they consulted other children, okay, who were older, and they got help with them concerning the whether they could give consent themselves, and just to wrap up, would you give incentives to enhance enrollment in the study? And if so, what kind of incentives?
Some of these children are working children. They work, so something to treat them, to compensate them for lost work, some food, travel expenses.
What about money?
Maybe
what about good old-fashioned money?
If it's a reasonable amount of money, like what they typical, like we've talked about this in the U.S., obviously it would probably be a lot lower there, what they may earn in a day or something like that. Depending how much time it takes.
The concern was that a lot of these kids weren't working, and that if you gave them money, they would buy drugs, and as told by the community representatives.
Maybe food.
Right. And the community representatives said, just give them a meal, and that's enough. It's the
just don't make it McDonald's.
Right. That would really be a lousy incentive.
I'm sorry. Is that decision of the community representative, like is he a leader? Probably is presenting his own perspective. But it would be better if he was presenting the idea of them collective. If they are taking drugs and you go ask them collective, I don't think that they might say we are going to buy drugs. Even if you say we are not going to give you money, they might choose what is best for them instead of somebody in high, or they are in high state, in a high position in the office, say give them meal. I don't think that is presenting the idea of the community.
Who else are you going to consult with?
As you said, if we have somebody, probably there are those like social workers who work with these children, probably they know particularly what they need.
I guess it all depends on whether you think the social workers know better or the so-called elders of the community, and that's a good question to ask, and maybe it's a combination.
Some people, if anybody could buy drugs, and they do, they feel almost like they're implicating or they're helping people with those habits and stuff like that, and they don't want to be morally implicated in that. So doing food or clothing or something else that's kind of, they can't easily translate it into drugs, makes the researchers feel much more comfortable with it.
I really enjoyed your engagement and discussions, and thanks a lot.
Thank you for joining us. Yes,
thanks. Yeah.
Can you get to John some specific sites for the London and the Poggi works?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'll send some of those articles.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Can I send it? You can see it. Yeah. I could have just seen the case, but I have not analyzed it. So I can send it to see the draft.
Yeah, let's see.
Are they walking first? Or can they have different stages? One time talking about the rest of somebody else, you get the holes.
Okay, then I'll clean it.
Probably they have.